So it was asked Doc to speak about Gemara rather than Tanakh, and the grounds that they already had many people were speaking on Tanakh, so wanted to do something else. The opening remarks were not worth repeating. I was asked Dafka to be part of the Talmud program today rather than the Tanakh. I have to apologize, I'll be mixing both. This is the way I am. I'll be mixing philosophy with Gemara as well, because that's what I do. I will... Are we okay now? Okay, can you hear now?
Yeah.
Everybody can hear?
Yes.
Does everybody want to hear?
Yes. Yes.
I will not be dealing with academic Talmud study, not because I think that's inappropriate, but simply because there's no time to do it in the time that I have, and there's nothing that I really want to bring from there to what we're doing today. That's one apology. Second apology is that the very nature of this meeting, I think it's supposed to be about women in Tanakh and Talmud, and one could make a very good argument that a lecture dealing with rape should belong to a day devoted to men in Bible and Talmud. But I asked the organizers what they mean by women, and they, you know, somehow they thought this belonged to the to what we're discussing now. Third problem has to do with rape, but I'll get back to that in a moment. I'm coming here with several goals. The real goal is study of Torah Lishma, to understand certain issues in Gemara and Rambam, in Tanakh, in Farshim. Clearly, there's another issue in the background as well, namely the question of what attitude we take towards rape. And make it very clear at the outset that the attitude that I take and the attitude that Sinkat Yadu takes towards rape is negative. But the question is exactly how that plays itself out. And I would say more particularly the sense that if you go through the halacha, that at certain points there are aspects of the halacha and of the psukim which could be viewed as being, quote-unquote, more lenient regarding rape than the intuitions of most or all the people sitting in this room now, and the kind of public policy that we would want to govern the way our society works, although I assume that the issue of capital punishment for rapists is not something that is practically an option for us right here. So here I want to get a broader perspective on these matters. I will do so with as little emotional involvement as I can marshal. We're studying Torah. It is obvious that some of the options that we'll look at will be more attractive to people than others, but our first task is to learn, and I don't see anything wrong in rooting for one achron over another, but we have to keep the rooting to ourselves, at least for a moment. Now, the halacha recognizes several different situations that could be referred to in some way as rape, but they come under a variety of halachic rubrics. Regarding an unmarried woman, we have the halacha of ones umefate. In both the situations, the ones would mean a forcible sexual encounter between a man and a woman. We call it rape. Mefate, we would translate as seduction, meaning consent. Same thing, but consensual. The Torah discusses these situations. There is a penalty on the rapist or the seducer, a greater penalty in the first case than the second case. In addition to that, the man is required to marry the woman if that's what she wants. and he is not allowed to divorce her without her consent. So in effect, if he did this, he is then stuck with the results. That's the one situation discussed in the Torah. Then there is a question of what happens when the woman is married. There are two situations we have there. One is Erusin and one is Nisuin, and we're speaking now about a Nara, meaning a woman who is no longer a child, but who is not yet fully mature, this early in-between stage. And here, the Nara Meorasa, if she has only been through Erusin, not yet through Nisuin, if the act is consensual, there is a penalty of skila. Fancy translation would be lapidation. See, people who are watch reruns of Tony Hancock or listen to the radio show would probably use the word stoning, which is a common word in that TV show, radio show. Stoning, which is more severe than the usual penalty for adultery, which would be chenek, strangulation. So there's a greater severity for the case of the na'arama orasa than for other cases. If it's consensual, they both get that penalty. If it is coerced, if it's rape, the man gets the penalty and the woman gets no penalty at all, as the Torah says. We may have time to come back to this pasuk. Tzakan Aram Orasa, she resisted him and nobody helped her. It's not her fault. She's not responsible. There is another case that I don't think we have time to get to, and I'm not really prepared to get into it right now, which is a case of rape within marriage. Husband who forces himself on his wife when she is not inclined that direction, and here there is no criminal penalty in halacha. There is a subject which we're not going to get to today, and maybe I'm just as relieved not to have to get into it, but so those are the categories that we have. Regarding Narama Orasa, you clearly have capital punishment. It is treated with enormous severity. Whether because of the rape or because of the adultery involved is not my concern right now. Regarding the onus mufate, there is a monetary penalty. And, of course, an existential one. He has to marry her if she insists he can't get rid of her. There is no criminal penalty. As most modern people, secular people, would assume that, first of all, adultery we would tend to be fairly lenient on. And what really becomes important is not the sexual act, but the element of force involved. And then we would not distinguish between onus without marriage or onus of a married woman. In either case, she's being forced to do something against her will. We might be more severe in the case of a younger woman. We'd say there's greater harm done there, there's a greater abusiveness there, but we would not make the distinction. Again, the Torah does make a distinction between adultery and non-adultery. Now, if you want to approach a subject, we have to ask what the purpose of penalties are to begin with. We're talking about why the Torah may seem to be more lenient than we would like it to be relative to other offenses. The question is, what are these penalties about to begin with? There are three possibilities, which I'll try to boil down to two for the sake of simplification. What is utility? You pay to compensate for a loss. You harmed somebody, you make it up to that person. Now, capital punishment does not really work very well from the point of view of utility, right? Because you kill the criminal, that doesn't really do any good for the person who suffered the harm. But we have that penalty for other reasons. In many cases, though, you pay damages, or you even pay beyond the damages, you're making up the harm that you did to somebody. Thirdly, we can talk about atonement. In the religious system, there would be a notion that through suffering a penalty, one gains a measure of kapara, one gains a measure of atonement for what one has done. Well, in a secular framework, I don't know how well that notion would operate. Certainly in general philosophy, we talk about retribution theories. They seem to presuppose that the criminal deserves something, and we seem to assume that once a criminal has been punished, the criminal in some sense is restored to society. Then the second category, somewhere in the middle, where I can speak about punishment as a way of restoring honor. That's not the same thing as utility. I insult somebody, I may not be able to make up for what I did. I can't pay the person. Give somebody money, it will make up for the harm. I libel somebody, and that caused the person to lose a job. I can pay money, and that money will compensate for the lost income. It does not compensate for the insult. There, you may say certain penalties compensate for the insult. The criminal pays a price, and the person says, well, you know, the insult has been paid for. I don't feel as insulted anymore. Society has made it up to me, or the criminal has made it up to me. Now, if we're coming back to the issue of onus mufate, what bothers us is treated as a monetary matter rather than as a criminal matter. To put it bluntly in halachic terms, the onus mufate pays money. They do not get a flogging. Let's not talk about capital punishment, but they don't even get a flogging. The normal thing in the Torah, you're a rasha, and rishut engenders flogging. Malkot. We don't have malkot for the rapist, unless, again, a married woman, and then other categories come into play. So, the question is that really true at a theoretical level? And the answer is, it's more complicated than they made it out to be. There is a prohibition of harming somebody physically. Well, you'll see, fakulto. The court is allowed to flog somebody, but if you flog beyond what the court allows, you flog beyond what the person really deserves, that is battery, and that's prohibited. And likewise, in the case of any kind of physical harm, there's a prohibition of causing physical harm to a fellow person. So the question then is, why don't you get malkot for that harm that is done? That goes beyond any kind of financial claim that is made. And the answer is that perhaps you really should. You slap a person, you punch a person, you really should get a flogging because it's a criminal act. And not just pay them to restore whatever harm you did to them, the day they lost from going to work or whatever. The only reason is that in the case of physical harm, there is another penalty, namely a monetary penalty. And the halacha is that you don't get both malkot and a monetary penalty. I can give you two different explanations of it. It could say to din of tudish uyot, that you... It's one penalty, you don't get double penalties. You choose which penalty to give. Or I could, if I wanted to, if I read the way that Rambam reads, I could say that the situation where somebody harms another person physically is a lav hanitak la'aseh. It is a prohibition which can be mended through a positive commandment, namely to pay for what you did. And therefore, the principle is that you don't get flogging in any situation where there is a positive redress to the situation. Whatever the reason is, physical harm does not engender the penalty of flogging, of malkot. With one exception, and that shows you the theoretical point involved here, if the physical harm is actually negligible, I punch somebody and it's only shavaprut, it's less than a shavapruta, the actual damage is not recoverable in court, it doesn't reach that threshold, then you may actually have flogging. Because you did the isur, you violated prohibition, the only thing is that you don't have restitution because you can't restore, you haven't reached the threshold of restoring. And then flogging comes out in the sun and we can all have fun. So at a practical level, you really don't have a physical penalty, a criminal penalty in these cases. You know, in theory, you do. Now, if we want to say theoretical issues are all that are important, we can say again that in the case of rape, in theory, there could be malkot. The only reason there is no malkot is simply because there is something else going on. There is a monetary payment which overshadows or replaces the malkot. But let's say we really are talking about a monetary payment. You ask me, why is there a monetary payment here rather than flogging, rather than a more robust kind of criminal penalty? There are three options I want to present to you. The first option, which sounds strange, would be to say that the monetary payment is really a more severe penalty than the malkot. I could say that. You'll tell me offhand, this is counterintuitive. Batla Daito, the Jack Benny Eitzel Kol Adam. You know the famous radio program where Jack Benny had a reputation as a miser. You're learning English radio shows, American radio shows today. His reputation as a miser, and his hold-up man comes up to him and says, "Your money or your life?" And there's a silence. I'm thinking it over. But that's not the way most people think. That's why it was funny. That's why I made a living with it. However, as odd as this position may seem to be, it is actually proposed as one option in the Gemara. Gemara Ketubot Lamed Beis, discussing the penalties of onus mufata, and the question comes up, what if you have a situation of onus mufata, which is also a situation of incest? Brother rapes a sister, brother seduces a sister. Why does the Mishnah say that then there will be the penalty? There will be a monetary penalty. Why should we not say that there is a penalty of karet, is a loss of life, which should take precedence over that? So Ula says, Lokasha. Ula says, we're making a distinction between various cases where there would be a penalty, meaning the case where there is no penalty would be a case where, no monetary penalty, would be a case where the woman is not capable of consent, there's no payment to her, and you know, and the normal case would be one where the monetary payment really would take precedence. So you get the monetary payment and not the other kinds of penalties, not the karet, not the capital punishment. Alma kasavar ula, the Gemara says, ula then seems to be saying that in a case where you have the possibility of either monetary payment or malkot, you pay the money and you don't get the malkot. Where does ula get such an idea? The ula says, well, the case of normal tort, chuvel b'chaviron, you hit somebody, you pay money and you don't get the flogging. So in any other case where there's monetary payment and malkot, the money takes precedence. So now the Gemara asks, what about chovel chavero? It's a bad analogy. It's chovel chavero. You have all kinds of five different penalties, which we'll get to in a couple of minutes. In the case of mamona, mamon doesn't fit that category. So then the Gemara suggests that mamon, the situation here is different. Shekein hutar mechlal beveidin. The case of chabala is one where there are situations where it is permissible to hit somebody, namely when the person is condemned to flogging, and therefore, even when you hit the person when it's not permitted, it means that hitting somebody is not to be viewed as such a severe penalty. And the Gemara answers that as well. That's the view of Ula. So according to Ula, there is at least a proposal to the effect that the monetary payment is more severe than the malkot. That when you give the person the monetary fine, you're making a greater demand on them than to get through the flogging. One comment of Tosfot here, which will become important for us in a moment. Tosfot says, Shani hacha, dechas v'chamana amamona shenachbal. And Tosfot says, in the case of chabala, the case where a person has been harmed physically by another person, there is a reason to give precedence to monetary payment, even if we don't hold a kula, because we are concerned about the harm done to the victim. Which means, let me translate Tosfot into the language that I used 10 minutes ago. According to Tosfot, utilitarian considerations take precedence over criminal considerations. Ula seems to be saying that from a criminal point of view, money can be more severe than flogging. Tosfot is saying that even if I don't hold like Ula, money may take precedent because we want to redress the wrong, because the victim needs the money, or ought to get the money, and flogging the criminal will not help the victim in any way. We'll come back to this Tosfot later. Again, it's counterintuitive, and the other views in the Gemara of Yochanan disagrees with it. Second option, I already indicated the idea of hutar mechlalo, the idea that in some way beating somebody up is less of a criminal act than other criminal acts. And again, this is a view that is not adopted overall in the Gemara. And it's also a problematic view because I could really ask you in that case, isn't any prohibition in the Torah, will in some circumstance or other, there'll be some opening for violating it? And again, the Rishonim talk about this, I will not belabor the point more. The third option, which is what I think is most important for us here, is that indeed, if you're looking at things from viewpoint of atonement, viewpoint of crime and punishment, then flogging is the right thing. Person is a rasha, flogging is just what the doctor ordered. But here we have to balance utilitarian considerations and the criminal considerations. The Torah does not pile on both. It's either one or the other. One takes precedence. Thus, if we hold that the monetary restitution is important, that would in fact squeeze out the flogging, the more typical criminal penalty. That's what's going to happen. And again, it may be exception when it's pachmu shevetruta. You can work in those exception situations. Which then means that in the same way that we may look at chabala, at physical harm for another person in an everyday context, we look at that as a criminal act, but also an act that engenders a need to make restitution, we can look at rape in the same way. There's a need for monetary restitution. To put it very bluntly, in addition to whatever insult, dishonor, and violence that is involved here, the woman who suffers rape or seduction, involving seduction, has been harmed financially and practically. You may not measure it in terms of days lost from work or medical bills, but in terms of the woman's value, in purely economic terms, harm has been committed. The Rambam in Monavuchim, when he discusses these laws, he says the reason that the rapist or the seducer is forced to marry the woman is because her value on the shidduch market has gone down, whether we like it or not. It's not a punishment that you're telling this guy, you know, you have to live with the old, with her, and you can't get rid of her. And an old battle axe, and, you know, no, it's simply that he caused an economic harm. He made it harder for her to get married, and therefore he has to take care of that. If we're talking about rape that is also adultery, then again, this is not the major concern that we have now. The one point that I want to make about that before coming back to onus and mufate is that there is this greater severity in the case of rape than in the case of adultery when we're dealing with an Ida, we're dealing with a younger woman, and this is an issue that requires some attention. The Nitziv in the commentary on Chumash in Tetzaveh, it's Dvarim, chapter 22, claims that in the case of onus of an aramorasa, a woman who is betrothed and is young, that there is an extra element of inui. There's an element which we probably translate as torment or oppression, and that justifies a more severe form of capital punishment. If you ask me then, well, why does a girl also get the more severe kind of punishment? Nitziv does not have an answer to that. But I could very well say that if you take a crime seriously, you cannot have a double standard. You really have to have the same kind of penalty for both sides. And the commentators in Chumash have other explanations as well. I'm not sure if we have time to go into them. In the case of Nara Morasa, bear in mind the Torah also makes a comparison between that and murder. When the woman, Torah says, a woman cried out and nobody helped her, it's just like a case of murder. The Gemara interpreted that to imply that the act of rape is really equivalent to an act of murder. Is that really what the pasuk means? Rashi and Ibn Ezra learn differently. According to both Rashi and Ibn Ezra, Kashirakumi Shoreehu is not describing the severity of the crime, but the helplessness of the victim. In the same way, in the case of murder, if you're murdered, obviously you couldn't help yourself. You didn't cooperate on your own. Similarly, in the case of rape, you did nothing at all. You were totally at the mercy of the criminal. But the Gemara did interpret it as defining the severity of the sin. let's go back to the question of onus lefata. So far we've assumed all the way through that rape is worse than any other kind of physical assault. We're taking it for granted that whatever we've said about physical assault should at least have the same severity in terms of physical assault with a sexual component. I want to look at one halacha which forces us to rethink that premise. Now, in order to do this, let's look at a couple of statements in Rambam which was advertised in the title of the lecture, going to Rambam, Sudu Rambam. Regarding any case of physical assault, there are five penalties, five monetary penalties that are levied. The Rambam should be in Chovel Mazik, chapter 5, halacha 6, Hevav. Rambam says, Hoda chovel shuchaval. Now here is a very important distinction in tort law. You have these five obligations that fall upon the tortfeasor. Those obligations apply when there are witnesses who say this man did the following. And then he is mulcted, he is obligated to pay the five types of penalty. What happens if he admitted it without the pressure of witnesses? He said, I did it, I'm guilty. Now you get an interesting distinction. The principle, a very familiar principle, halacha modeh b'knas patur. If you admit your liability in a case that involves a fine, you're exempt from the fine. If you admit that you took somebody's money, you clearly have to pay. You don't say, well, I admitted that I stole your money, therefore I don't pay it back. But you would be exempt from any additional criminal penalty. Which means that while in halacha we don't use the terms criminal or civil, and those who deal with legal theory, philosophy of law, know that that distinction has come under fire within American law as well. These are issues can be discussed further, but the terms used ordinarily in the street, they talk about civil and criminal penalties, and to some degree, within halacha, we could use the distinction mamon and knas between owing somebody something and being fined as being parallel to that kind of penalty. I know that you very often have fines in American law that have nothing to do with criminal action. You owe taxes, they'll assess you a fine, but again, that's not criminal. That's, you know, those other purposes. By and large, you could say knas implies a criminal penalty. It's something the person deserves for their crime, whereas mamon means something you owe. So that distinction becomes very important. The Rambam says, Hoda chovel shuchaval, the tortfeasor confesses, he said, I did it. In lo hayusham edim klav, if there were witnesses, we assume that he's doing so under the pressure of the witnesses, but you didn't have the pressure of witnesses. Hu omer chaval tabi v'hoda, somebody said, you punched me up the bracket, and he admitted it. Patur min hanezek min hatzar. He does not have to pay the damage or the aggravation for the battery. What he is obligated to pay on his own is shevet, time lost from work, and boshet, embarrassment, like punch somebody, it causes them a degree of embarrassment. And vipui, meaning medical bills. So those things he pays in his own, which means if I take the logic that I developed a moment ago, the analogy from civil and criminal, it would mean that payment to the medical bills, payment for lost time at work, and bullshit, so-called embarrassment, those would be debts that you owe the person. And the other two, nezek and tsar, aggravation, feelings that one has, that would, the pain involved, that would not, that would be penalty, that would not be the initial civil situation. Just look quickly at Hilchot Toin V'Nitan, 1:16 Aleph Tet Zayin. Man accuses somebody of having punched him up, chaval tabi, and the accused criminal says nothing happened, they never did it. Nishbah haseit. He's obligated to take an oath that he did not cause that tort, but even though a person does not pay knas on his own, meaning if he admits it, he would not be obligated to pay the knas, but he does pay the shevet, ripui, and boshet. And something where he does have to take that oath to get himself off the hook. I go to the halacha regarding onus mufate. Is not a betula, bait you bait. The Rambam says, Ein adam mishalem knas b'chol makom v'dat piv el al piedim. In general, a person does not pay a knas, he does not pay a fine on his own admission, but only when there are witnesses to compel him. Therefore, ha'omer anasti upititi b'toshel ploni, man says, I am a seducer, I'm a rapist, eino mishalem knas. He does not pay the fine. Aval mishalem boshet ufgam behodat piv. The boshet he pays, and he pays pgam, meaning the loss of the woman's value, so to speak, in the marriage market. So boshet he does pay. Which implies, based on the logic I developed now, that while in general, when it comes to torts, the Rambam would say that the obligation of the monetary obligation, not the fine, but the direct debt obligation, would include the shevet and ripui and boshet, the same thing would be true in terms of the whatchamacallit, in terms of the onus mufate, that the boshet of gam he would be responsible for. And a rapist pays a boshet on his own. Whereas again, Chovel Mazik, the Rambam says the opposite. So what is the Rambam doing here? How do we explain the Rambam? One possibility is that the Rambam really is churning the various tort obligations, the rapist, are being turned into straight monetary obligation. But even though we would say that the boshet, in the case of Chovel Mazik, would be viewed one way, in terms of the case of rape, we're turning it into mamon. This would be something that would be troubling from our point of view. But we would want to say that in the case of rape, it's really more criminal than the case of just an everyday act of torts. The Rambam seems to be going the other direction here, but saying that boshet is assimilated to monetary obligation rather than to to the criminal penalty, so to speak. There are a couple of possibilities that we can raise in trying to understand this Rambam. And as we're discussing the Rambam, it's because the Gemara is not explicit in this, so we really are talking about the Rambam. One possibility, which is raised by the Or Sameach in Halachot Mazik and a little bit also in Halachot Mechira, the passage I didn't expose you to, would imply that the penalty in this case has something to do with the way the rapist thinks rather than with any objective halachic kind of approach. What do I mean by that? It means that when a person admits that they are liable for having done something, and you ask the criminal, what do you think that obligates you to do? Ordinarily, you would imagine that you're a thief. You say to yourself, I stole the money, I ought to return it. And somebody would say, what about paying the fine, paying double? The thief would say, oh, that is a penalty. And a thief might accept that with a smile or like that, but the thief would say, that's a criminal penalty. That's what I get for being a criminal. In terms of the rapist, the person engaged in forcible sex, because he may not call himself a rapist, he just admit that he got a little rough, the rapist, in his mind, may accept the notion that paying the boshet is something that he owes her and not merely something that is imposed upon him by the courts. He may think of it in those terms. He may realize that that's something that he owes rather than something that he's paying because he's being penalized. Now, why it should be the case that only in this case do we look at the outlook of the criminal, we don't make an objective decision regardless of how the criminal feels about himself, is an interesting question. But according to Meir Simcha, according to Yer Sameach, the criminal in this case is taking direct monetary responsibility for that kind of harm. And that direct responsibility means that his own admission can obligate him to pay that additional money. That's one option that we have here. There is a second option, and that is the option that will probably be least popular from the viewpoint of modern people. This is found in the work of one of the greatest men to have taught in our yeshiva, Rav Shimon Shkop. Was a yeshiva here in before World War II. Rav Shimon really does treat the situation of Oren Tzvi Mefata very much in monetary terms. Rav Shimon actually says about Bel Yosef, the situation we talked about half an hour ago, when we discussed the question of somebody getting malkot for physical assault, assuming that that assault had so little monetary effect that you can't require payment, so all you've got is the criminal liability. And if Shimon says, well, that might be true in terms of assault in general, but in the case that we're discussing, in case of onus mefata, the primary aim of the offender is not to inflict pain, but rather to get pleasure. In assault, I'm beating somebody up, and I take whatever responsibility there is for that. In the case of rape, and something we certainly hear from many rapists, and many even more seducers, look, I wanted to have fun, and, you know, she agreed to it, she didn't agree to it, I'm a little vague about that. But you really don't want to treat it as an act of violence, per se. And that means that you really treat it as more of an economic transaction than you would treat normal assault. We've assumed all along that this should be the other way around, but he seems to assume this way. I think this goes, with all due respect to Shimon Shkup, this goes against what I think we know, namely that in many, many cases, forcible sexual exploitation has less to do with quote-unquote love than it has to do with violence. Very often the violence is really more important than whatever sexual satisfaction there is here. I think it's something that a person could figure out psychologically without needing all the social scientists. However, I wonder whether, let's say, if Shimon Shkup were in dialogue with us today, would he have felt the need to revise that analysis? We don't know. Died 7 years ago. And again, I think that, with all due respect, that even in Lomdus, even in impersonal Lomdus, it should be informed by psychological insight, and Shimon Shkup was probably the last of the great Lithuanian Dolin who disagree with me about that, because when you read his writing, when he deals with purely monetary matters, he is quite willing to think psychologically out of the box. In this case, though, I'm just telling you what we have, and I'm reporting it. The third option, in terms of, so again, according to the Shimon Shkup, we certainly could be, in terms of explaining the Rambam, we could certainly explain the Rambam in terms of the notion that it is a kind of economic transaction, and that whatever harm is causing to a woman should be measured in economic terms and can be measured in economic terms. And if he's committed an assault, then in effect, he got his money's worth, he should pay his money's worth, so to speak. The third option, which is probably the most acceptable to most of us, appears in other of the great Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, this is on the Malser, Ibn Azel. Ibn Azel's approach here goes back to an analysis of what exactly motive and mixit involves. What does it mean for a person to confess part of the obligation and not the entire obligation? Now again, we know that in halacha, if I tell you, you owe me $100. If you deny the whole thing, then based on biblical law, you don't owe me anything. You denied it, I have no witnesses, I can't do anything to you. If you admit part of it, I demand $100 from you, you admit that you owe me $50 or $25, then you're obligated to take an oath. Because that's the halacha, and how you explain the halacha is not my concern right now, and that's time is coming to an end, and we're not learning. Maybe when we'll have the session next year on halachot applying to men or men's issues, maybe that be viewed as being particularly connected with men. Now, Rabbi Zalman's analysis of motive b'knas ran along fairly original lines. He said, in case of motive b'knas, the person who admits that he owes the knas money. I'll go back again, the case of theft. I'm accused of theft, and I admit, without witnesses, I admit that I stole it. So I'm only obligated to repay what I stole. I'm not obligated to pay double, to pay the penalty. The Rabbi Zalman held that in that case, we simply do not believe the person. If the person says, I admit that I stole, it's that we say you're obligated to repay the money, but we'll do you a favor, we'll exempt you from the penalties. We'll be nice to you. It is rather that when he says, I am a thief, we believe him when he says, I owe the money. We do not give him any particular credence. He has no authority to assert that he is guilty of the criminal action that entails that additional penalty. So we accept the assertion of monetary indebtedness. Why? Because it's power to make the commitment. If I tell you I owe you $100, I have a right to tell you I owe $100. I have a right to give you a gift of $100. I have special authority, I'm believed about it, I have the authority to do so. The same way I can tell you I owe you $100 because I borrowed $100. I owe you $100 because I feel like giving you $100. I can say I owe you $100 because I stole $100 from you. We believe a person. You have the power to create financial indebtedness. I don't have the power to create criminal liability for myself. We accept the confession that he owes the money. We ignore any criminal aspect of the confession. That shifts the burden to the intention of the rapist, or the purported rapist. And that really means that those obligations that flow from restitution, that he is obligated to do, and those obligations that are not part of restitution, will count as a knas. In a case of rape, we would say that according to the Solomon, according to Ibn Azel, when I say that I raped the woman, I am committing myself to pay for the bullshit. I'm not committing myself to pay for the purely penalty aspects of things, but the bullshit, which is in the middle, which ordinarily in the case of assault, I would not regard as my personal obligation. And I would have no right to obligate myself to do. In a case of rape, we would be meeting a higher standard because you would expect the criminal who's making the confession to take that kind of responsibility. I think we've come to the end of the time that we have here. There's several other points that I want to pursue in terms of just reading the Chumash. There are other points having to do with actually the question of rape and marriage, which I was just happy I didn't have to get to. What I hope we accomplish now is a very rushed tour. What I hope to accomplish here is a few things. Again, if you should have learned Rambam, you should have gone through some Achronim, the Shema. The second element, when speaking about Hashkafa, is that we should understand that the study of Halacha, even the study of Lamedus, does at some level plug into issues of Hashkafa, issues of how we look at people, how we think about our lives as well. The relationship is problematic. We cannot afford to allow our ideological constraints to dictate what we read, what we don't read in the halachic texts. We have to read of Shimon Shkaf whether we like it or not. At the same time, I think it does create a framework where we can see these things in a larger way. And very importantly, it is something that flows both ways. That if we do this with the proper kind of detachment and control, I think it allows us to make judgments about what we're doing with learning from others. I could say more about this a little longer, but we've used up the time and we're getting off on the signals from the back. And,